News stories have been circulating for months about human trafficking and slave markets, with reporting tying the movement of refugees from North Africa into Europe to the emergence of a slave market in Libya. What the international reporting often obscures is the reality that human trafficking takes place in the United States as well. According to Polaris, an organization that collects data on human trafficking, there were more than 8,000 reports of trafficking in the U.S. in 2016. That includes reports of both labor and sex trafficking, although Polaris points out that labor trafficking is underreported in the United States. The data of human trafficking is the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories. Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Joining me in the studio is regular panelist John Baylor, chair of Miami's Statistics Department. Richard Campbell is away today. Today's guest is Dr. Davina Dargana. She's an international human rights statistician with the Walk Free Foundation. She's also a researcher whose work sits at the intersection of technology, statistics, and human trafficking. And she's worked on the subject with a number of organizations, including the Department of Justice and Polaris Project. Thank you so much for being here today, Davina.
Thanks so much, Rosemary. It's my honor.
How did human trafficking become your research focus?
Absolutely. You know, human trafficking, when I started looking at this in 2006, wasn't really a common topic of conversation. I think I remember my parents explaining to people what I was studying and what I was interested in, and they had to define it. And if you can imagine, in a pre-Liam Neeson Taken environment, this is so amazing to me that now there's so much interest in our work. There's lots of funding going into our work, although I think any field will always say there could always be more. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that we're seeing so much attention to this. But initially, when I came across human trafficking, it was actually in an international context, and I just was really taken by vulnerable minors in situations of post-conflict, particularly in El Salvador, and seeing how a lack of a capable guardian in the form of law enforcement and functioning government really made these children very vulnerable. But then I came back to the U.S. and realized it was a problem here too. So, I mean, I guess seeing something that you thought would only be international in your backyard is a huge problem.
Let me follow up with a quick question. I'm just curious about how is slavery formally defined? I mean, one question about studying this is just an operational definition of it.
Oh, yeah. And it's the lack of an operational definition that's universally agreed upon is really a stumbling block in a lot of our work globally. But I would say that the tenets of slavery really come down to the exploitation of one person or multiple people for commercial gain. And that can be in either labor or sex industries. But essentially, if someone is working and unable to leave that that position, whether it's in sex or labor, and someone else is making a profit off of that, and that can be monetary, it can be in terms of drugs, services, anything, then we would consider that to be a situation of slavery. Often, in a lot of the work that I do in vulnerability modeling, it gets a little complicated because people start saying, well, you know, what's the difference really? Like, what's the difference between sexual assault and trafficking at the end of the day when you're determining vulnerabilities? And really, the difference becomes the motivation of the offender. So what is the trafficker thinking to do? Are they looking to rape someone for personal gratification? Or are they looking to exploit the sexual assault of an individual or the sexual abuse of an individual for commercial gain?
Mm-hmm. Since you bring up the issue of modeling, I was going to ask you, so trafficking, right, involves people who are being moved sort of under the cover of legality, right? It's not as though this is a legal thing that's happening. How do you measure the number of individuals who are being trafficked if this is something that isn't, again, it's not something that you can follow legally?
Oh, yeah. It makes it very difficult. In fact, I would say that a lot of our work is really an underestimate, and it's shocking given how high some of these numbers become, but I would still say that a lot of our estimates are still conservative. So we actually just published a report on the Walk Free Foundation working with the International Labor Organization on a joint global estimate of modern slavery based on survey, a nationally representative survey program in over 48 countries around the world.
Wow.
And we estimated that in 2016, on any given day, there were 40.3 million people enslaved. But keep in mind, this is based on survey data that is not reaching many populations. So it's nationally representative, of course, meaning that we're not oversampling in very vulnerable populations. We're not identifying necessarily the labor camps or the institutionalized populations, prisons, mm-hmm. Orphanages, other vulnerable groups. So, I mean, it's quite shocking when you think about those numbers and how big they sound, but then realizing that we really are underestimating it.
So how do you even start such a survey?
Yeah, it's really tough. So basically, when we started the Global Slavery Index, we began with a partnership with Gallup World Poll. Mm-hmm. And you may be familiar with them. They're public opinion surveys, and they do them in very many countries around the world. And essentially, we started by adding time in certain countries dedicated to modern slavery. So basically, we've tried to come down on those essential questions that would identify victims of modern slavery or enable them to self-identify when interviewed. And often we focus on labor exploitation, sexual exploitation, and forced marriage in our survey modules. So that's kind of the starting point for us. But then we came into the issue where surveys, and especially face-to-face national representative surveys, are not really conducive in developed countries, where if we had a sample of 1,000 people in the United States, it's unlikely that we would be able to detect something that's so hidden here.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so now we're looking at different approaches, such as multiple systems estimation, where we work directly with governments to essentially, it's a capture-recapture method that looks at identified victims across multiple administrative lists, and we try to estimate the unknown or the people that have not been identified based on that information, the number of repeats of a certain victim.
When you talked about slavery, you almost, as part of your operational definition, it sounded like labor exploitation, sexual exploitation, and forced marriage were three of the categories that came pretty quickly to mind for you. Would you say those are kind of the biggest examples of slavery in the modern world?
Well, I think there's certainly so there are certain types of slavery, and again, this comes back to the universal definition, right? So some people would consider organ trafficking a form of modern slavery. But it becomes very difficult to operationalize in some of these contexts. I think the reason we focus on forced marriage, forced labor, and forced sexual exploitation is because those are three broad categories that we think are pretty pretty well accepted in terms of what constitutes modern slavery. And then, of course, there's still some debate about like those categories. So what is the difference between labor exploitation and labor trafficking? Even in the U.S., we haven't figured this out, so it becomes really difficult to kind of put that external measure and benchmark against vulnerable people. So when we were thinking about labor exploitation, it's an interesting example, because we tend to see that that's also underrepresented in people that are able to self-identify, and we think a lot of that can be attributed to men as victims who are in very exploitative, essentially trafficking situations for labor, but are almost socialized to believe that this type of treatment and behavior and working condition is to be expected, given the lack of other viable employment opportunities. So it's kind of really so sad that that we're really seeing labor exploitation and labor trafficking victims having a difficult time self-identifying, because this has been so much of what they've been socialized and conditioned to accept as normal.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. The topic today is the stats on human trafficking and modern slavery. You mentioned the difficulty that researchers have in defining what is slavery and defining what is trafficking. I would imagine that the difficulty you guys sort of face as you're studying this might lead to some frustration with the way the media might be covering it. And I wondered if you could take a moment to maybe talk about what some of your frustrations might be of journalists who are covering the issue of human trafficking.
Rosemary, that is such an excellent question. I actually do a lot of interviews for our Spanish and sometimes our French media outlets. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that becomes really challenging is, even as a statistician who should be the most comfortable pushing back on oversimplification of our numbers and big takeaways, I still find it challenging a lot of times to keep sticking to those caveats. Like, yes, we estimate that it's this many thousand people in your country this year, but this is how we derived it. I think one of the challenges I face, and I think my colleagues might agree with journalists and media portrayal of a lot of this information, is that often we really are looking for that one big number, that big shiny takeaway, and the caveats sometimes fall to the side, or the details that make a substantial difference to how those numbers are interpreted and used mm-hmm. aren't often the centerpiece of those stories.
Yeah, when you mentioned the 40.3 million people,
yeah.
I mean, that I was thinking, okay, how do you propagate error through a calculation like that? How big is the interval? You know, if you were looking at how much uncertainty is part of that estimate?
Well, and so this is the challenge we do face. So we have on the International Labor Organization's website and on the Walker Foundation website, we do have our technical paper that has standard errors and all of the technical detail there. But to answer your question, I mean, essentially, we are looking at a survey program of 48 countries to give mm-hmm. us information on just over 200 countries.
Oh.
And so there's a fair amount of extrapolation yeah. involved in terms of how we allocate slavery proportions by region. And then additionally, we had to supplement the survey data, which was really comprehensive on forced labor and forced marriage, because that's how our modules were kind of constructed, with additional information on child sexual exploitation from partners at International Organization for Migration and other data sources on state-imposed forced labor from the International Labor Organization. So you can even imagine how, aside from just the strict extrapolation from our survey program to these over 200 countries, we also had to integrate other data sources. So it became quite complicated and not really as you know, straightforward as one might, you know, assume or hope that the state of global anti-slavery data may be in. So I think, as I mentioned, I mean, the uncertainty is, I'm pretty confident with, for the state of global data, I'm pretty confident with the estimates that we've derived. But the part that still continues to frustrate me and my colleagues is that there are so many populations that we are just not reaching very well. And I think Rosemary in her introduction mentioned the refugee population.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's another area where really I don't know that that a nationally representative survey can reliably capture populations that are so transient and being frequently moved and discounted within the countries that they're currently residing. So it is a huge challenge, and we are trying different things to alleviate that, and like new approaches over samples and partnership with UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugee, mm-hmm. and trying to think about different ways to measure that to have just better estimates.
So given the complicated nature of this data, and that there is so much nuance in it, what advice would you give to journalists who are going to come to your site and try to figure out what kind of story to tell? What advice would you give to them as they were sort of looking through all this data?
One good piece of advice I would probably give to them is essentially the same process I think any researcher or academic might use in trying to determine what's the key takeaway from this article or the key message for this this policy application. And I think that would be to really think about what the outcome is that you're looking to achieve. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of times we report the number, but there's not much context beyond that, right? This number is kind of like a splashy number that's meant to grab attention, but it also serves a purpose, right? So for countries in which that's not a survey estimate, it's the product of extrapolation, let's say, that number should be taken into context with the region, right? To tell you proportionally, how are you doing relative to the other countries mm-hmm. in your area, yeah. the other countries that may be similar to you.
Yeah.
I think that there's a bit more context that we can think about, but that probably starts with crafting a little bit of the story and doing a little bit of qualitative research as well.
Yeah.
Try to understand kind of how to make sense of the numbers that we provide.
You know, one thing I'm curious about is what are some of the predictors of slavery?
Mm. Yes. Well, that's the part that I'm really most excited about. So we've been working on a vulnerability model since the inception of the index. And essentially, the vulnerability model itself is limited in a few key ways. First, it's a global vulnerability model. So we're dependent on data sources that report regularly and transparently for 167 countries in the Global Slavery Index. So as you can imagine, there's not really a whole lot to choose from, but we do optimize what we can find. On the basis of those predictors, though, we've started and over the years have come to formalize more of a grand theory of vulnerability in modern slavery, and we're going to be submitting that for publication in the coming month. So oh, wow. It's quite exciting when we think about how do we disaggregate vulnerability to a point that we can have meaningful policy interventions. And okay. So two cornerstones of our thinking on drivers of slavery specifically have to do with human security theory, which disaggregates vulnerability from this monolithic experience of being vulnerable to anything or to a crime, and breaks it into seven area components that are consistent with the United Nations Development Program's conceptualization of this, which is great for the Sustainable Development Goals and other global metrics. But basically, we look at things like food insecurity, environmental insecurity, political insecurity, health insecurity, economic insecurity, personal insecurity, community insecurity. And by looking at things in this kind of disaggregated way, it forces us to be more comprehensive about the risk factors that we even include in a model like this. But it also allows us to differentiate. So I think a lot of times people attribute, or activists may attribute, poverty or economic insecurity to a broad range of vulnerabilities to many crimes, not just slavery. But when breaking them up and trying to look at the distinguishing characteristics of each type of vulnerability, one thing that I found in a study I did in 2013 and 14 of U.S. minors was actually that among minor U.S. citizens and minor foreign nationals in the U.S., victims of modern slavery, different types of vulnerability were more relevant for different populations. Mm-hmm. So for U.S. citizens, we were looking at community and personal insecurity, which is fascinating when you think about Robert Putnam and the decline of civil society in America and the implications for that. Because a lot of times when we're talking about slavery intervention, we're not talking about additional funding for Big Brothers Big Sisters or National Court Appointed Special Advocates or other civil society organizations. We're often talking about different types of interventions. So it's just kind of interesting when we start thinking about how we can be more targeted in our policy approaches.
So are there particular countries where the estimates that you generate, you're very confident with them? I mean, you've mentioned already that you're doing extrapolation to some countries. But so let's taking the extrapolation off the table and just focusing on where you think you have pretty good data in terms of you actually have data from countries. Are there ones that are especially good in terms of precision? And can you talk about why that you think those are better than others?
Sure. Well, I would definitely start with our survey countries. So I think having essentially having countries in which we've gone through this process with Gallup, we have these nationally representative surveys. I would say for some developing countries, even though we're still missing a lot of our our very vulnerable populations, I still think that those survey countries in developing contexts are really reliable. We also are starting to do multiple systems estimation throughout Europe. And in the coming year, we're planning on having results for Serbia, Romania, Belarus, and Ireland. So it would be really exciting. I think those types of countries, so our survey countries, which include, which will include countries like Afghanistan, Argentina, Botswana, Brazil, Cambodia, a lot of those countries. And I would feel very confident with those estimates. I mean, again, as an underestimate, but still more confident because they are part of this nationally representative survey program, as well as on the developed country side, the ones that we've instituted multiple systems estimation.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and our discussion today focuses on human trafficking. Davina, what stories do you think reporters are missing in all of the sort of information that you and other researchers are collecting on human trafficking?
Yeah, something I think that reporters might be missing really focuses on the cultures that lead to underreporting among certain populations. Huh. So one narrative that's not being captured quite accurately in our numbers is the extent of labor exploitation of males. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned earlier, part of that is self-identification. Part of that is just horrendous labor conditions that have kind of been normalized. But I think media and the public can really contribute in a meaningful way if they start to think about how we can address this culture of labor exploitation. So how do we get the message out about what labor, basic labor rights are inherent in each country? How do we start to flip the script on labor exploitation from potential exploitative employers to empowering those that may be taken advantage of?
So let me follow up with that. You had talked about the idea of exploitation and trafficking and sort of confusion about this. Could you just go through a little bit of clarification of traffic, you know, labor exploitation, labor trafficking? How do those differ? How would someone know, you know, how would someone know if they're being exploited versus a victim of trafficking? Can you give examples to illustrate?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I think of it more of a continuum or of a spectrum. So on the one end of the spectrum, I would say there's labor exploitation, and that could range from anything essentially from unpaid internships to low wage workers that are just below minimum wage, let's say. So you've got like legal compliance issues there, but largely people are free to leave. Essentially, if you had one of those positions, no one's detaining your documents, no one's threatening your family, no one's making threats against you, you could leave that situation. On the other end of that spectrum, you're going to have a lot of the same behaviors. You're going to have poor working conditions, exploitative employers, but at the labor trafficking end of the spectrum, you will not be able to leave that position. And that could be because you're physically detained or prevented a freedom of movement, or it could be because threats are being made against you and your family. So I think the range of experiences can vary a little bit, but at the end of the day, labor exploitation would mean that although you were facing difficult and terrible labor conditions, you were still that are not in compliance with your local federal wage laws, you would still be able to leave. Whereas in a situation of trafficking, typically you would not be able to leave.
So it seems like globally and domestically, the issue of labor trafficking is underreported or seems to be underreported. Mm-hmm. Are there other things that are leading to this underrepresentation or underreporting of labor trafficking in the larger statistics?
Yeah, I think, well, so aside from self-identification, which is going to be most easily visible in our survey, our nationally representative survey results, because of course, that's always going to be very challenging. So even another challenge we have with self-reporting, of course, is trafficking of minors, of children.
Yeah.
So our surveys, we can only administer them to people that are 15 years of age and older.
Okay.
And so often if we ask somebody about a situation of modern slavery, they're going to be reporting about themselves or someone in their immediate family. But that information is often not as robust. If you were to ask me like what's going on with my my child who's been working as a restavec in the city, I may not have a very accurate sense of what their experience has been like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to weight those reporting items accordingly. I think something else that's contributing to the challenge around labor exploitation is that we are not quite in a national representative survey. We are also presumably missing out on informal labor camps and places where migrant workers and others might be concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
So because our survey sampling frame is based on census data, essentially officially held government census data, you're looking then at populations that could be hugely dense that just won't be captured appropriately in the sampling frame.
You know, it sounds like what your group is doing is working very hard to establish baselines and baselines for this problem, and then ultimately with the hope of designing and then maybe promoting interventions to try to reduce this. So what are some of the ideas of interventions that you would advocate and that you would like to study and investigate?
Absolutely. You know, this is actually really a great question, John. So one thing I was remiss in doing is that we do have some partner organizations that take a lot of this type of research a step further. So we have colleagues in London. They're based in London. It's called the Freedom Fund, and they do a lot of hotspot intervention work. So they'll look at a lot of the survey data. We're partner organizations, so we often freely share information. And so they'll say, let's pick this this community in India, and they'll test an intervention in that context. And my colleague Yuki has done some really fascinating research in testing the effects of certain interventions on populations, and that could be sex worker engagement and awareness. She tells a really funny story about how sometimes by trying to empower sex workers and to hire them as interviewees, as interviewers of other potential victims, they run into the challenge where the pay that they are earning as an interviewer isn't often as lucrative as their sex work. So sometimes people will kind of end a shift early, an interview shift early, to then go and participate in sex work and then return to it. So it's kind of interesting when you think about that and the realities of implementation of these types of intervention on the ground and even research in this field on the ground. And we have really excellent partners that are executing that.
You mentioned Taken at the beginning of this conversation. and I'm thinking, too, there's been a lot of reporting about the slave market in Libya. There was a lot of reporting this time last year, I think, about the fishermen in Southeast Asia who were basically enslaved to sort of, fish for shrimp and things. And I'm wondering, how much are you as a researcher, when you're trying to present this information, working against media representations of slavery, be they good or bad, right? I would wager a guess that Taken is probably not the most representative representation of sort of modern slavery. So how much, when you are thinking about how to package your information, are you thinking about how to counteract things that are circulating in mass media?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Taken, for what it was, it still elevated the issue of slavery mm-hmm. in the U.S. context in a way that spoke to people, right? So I think there are always going to be subsections of the field and of the advocacy world and anti-slavery work, like, sexual exploitation of children, for example, that will have an important and meaningful role in this space. And if it brings more awareness and more funding to this issue, then I very rarely have an issue with it.
Yeah.
The interesting example you raised, though, about the slave markets in Libya, I've been asked about this so many times. And the one thing I keep coming back to is that I think actually the publicizing of those slave markets is so important mm-hmm. because for a long time as an international community, we've been really ignoring the tremendous risks that we've been placing these refugees under. I mean, we were aware that there's a crisis in Syria. We're aware that there are going to continue to be more environmental refugees, more civil conflict refugees. We're going to have this as a part of our world dynamic for the foreseeable future. And I think we've almost kind of pretended, this is happening somewhere else. It's not quite our responsibility. This isn't a problem that really affects us. And I think showing that this is happening, that people are so emboldened as to the disregard of these people, these refugees, that it's not enough that they're being drowned and turned away at borders, at ocean borders. It's now that they're physically being sold in a market. And what that tells me really is that the level of public acceptance of the mistreatment of these people has risen astronomically. So people could have always, had slave markets online or surreptitiously and, behind closed doors. But the fact that they would have one in a rather public setting is quite disturbing, because it really shows the extent to which we've ignored the plight of a lot of these refugees. So from my perspective, I think one thing the media does really well is that they do humanize this issue. And by raising this, they're not allowing people to turn away and say, oh, but it's, the refugee issue is complicated, but we don't know what to do about it. I mean, this is kind of saying, like, the worst human rights abuses are happening to these people. And there's a really wonderful quote by, I believe it's William Wilberforce, but it's essentially like, you can choose to do nothing, but you can never again say that you didn't know, right? So at least this is raising the issue to the point that people are aware of it. And now the burden to act really falls on our shoulders.
So suppose someone's really inspired by this conversation or by the work that you're doing. What are some of the skills that someone would need to work in this area, to be able to contribute, whether it's to the methodological components or to investigating this problem?
Yeah, well, a lot of people do seem to be very interested in getting involved in our field. And something I'll always say is that there is space in this field for everybody. So there are really inspiring stories of truckers against trafficking. So these are truck drivers that advocate against the commercial sexual exploitation of minors at truck stops. They are, active in that space. There's a tattoo artist association that's really focused on branding tattoos that are being used on people and raising awareness of that in their industry. So in general, I think any skills you have, if you're interested in legal work, if you're interested in social work, if you're interested in advocacy or even, you know, corporate social responsibility, I think there's a lot of ways that you could be involved in this. For example, Marriott Hotel, they do some really interesting things about human trafficking awareness because their hotels may or may not be used for some of these sex acts. So I think examples of companies like that that are taking initiative and responsibility is really amazing. In terms of the methodological side, I would say we always need better researchers. So we are always going to be in a situation of imperfect data, of messy data, of trying to make sense in a social science and international affairs context of this type of research. So I think if you're interested in working on a global scale, if you're interested in looking at comparative regional analyses of slavery or even any other human rights issues, having a solid background in like a social sciences that can be matched with the technical skills of statistics or any kind of data analytics really would be so amazing. And especially now, if you're young and you're still learning, or if you're not so young and you're still learning, I think, you know, things like I've always loved Bayesian analysis, and we're starting to look at how to use that more to integrate expert input and iterations of modeling that can be more sophisticated. You know, machine learning is something that many of us can, you know, teach ourselves essentially at the very basic levels. Different types of programming languages are always super useful. So that's something that I find very funny is that, you know, STATA is very common with, you know, the UN organizations that we work with or some of the government organizations, but then now for its its free cost, often we're looking to use R and different things. It's kind of exciting, but I would say if there's something that you like and that you're passionate about, to just pursue that and just continue to apply it to the slavery field. And I'd love to make myself available to any student or any person that's interested in trying to figure that out, because we definitely need more brain power and more committed people on this field.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Davina Durgana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you both. I really appreciate it.
It was great chatting with you.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film and the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter or iTunes if you'd like to share your thoughts on the program. Send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu and be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.